The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia. Yes, this is episode 137 of Columbia Calling, and we'll have Roxanne Cristalli on the line from Boston talking to us about gender issues regarding the peace dialogues with the FARC guerrillas and subsequently gender issues with the upcoming, hopefully, peace dialogues with the ELN guerrillas. But of course, those are under some sort of questionable doubt at the moment, given what President Santos declared on Friday when he reprimanded the group, the ELN, that's the National Liberation Army, but he reprimanded the group for their lack of seriousness regarding these talks. Because on March 30th, the announcement was made that the exploratory phase for the peace talks had come to an end, and they had reached an agreement for an agenda, and that at some point in the near future they would be announcing the commencement of the dialogues, peace dialogues, with the second guerrilla group. They number about 1,500 men, but are strategically positioned around the country in incredibly, let's say, affluent areas. I'm not saying that affluent in terms of nice neighborhoods, but they are, as is demonstrated very frequently, they are able to blow up sections of the Caño Limón Coveñas pipeline, which runs along the border with Venezuela, then emptying out for exportation in the Caribbean. And see, they are able to attack that with relative ease, and of course their positions as well in Santander, Cesar, and the south of Bolivar. So, you know, it's a tough situation, and on March 30th, President Santos did announce that there would be peace dialogues. They would be commencing, and most likely they would start in Ecuador. Now, that was the belief, but of course, since the earthquake in Ecuador, which has left so many dead and been a real tragedy for our sister country, our neighboring country to Colombia, that has been thrown into some doubt. But we still expected something to be announced. Given the way our president behaves and his politics, we expected him to move forward with details of the talks. But as yet, nothing has come up. And so on Friday, President Santos, in a televised address to the nation from the Palacio de Nariño, reprimanded the ELN guerrilla group. So we watch and we wait, and we'll see what comes of that and how the ELN decide to respond, if of course they respond. On the other hand, slightly more upbeat though, what we can say is that the talks with the FARC that have been going on since November 2012 in Havana, Cuba, seem to be reaching their final phase. They are talking about disarmament, and that's what I've been told. On the down low, they're talking about disarmament and security issues for demobilized FARC combatants, which of course is a major concern. It's a major concern because we only need to look at the Holocaust that took place, the genocide that took place against the members of the Unión Patriótica, or the Patriotic Union political party, which was a political party started by demobilized members of the FARC guerrillas, who were then subsequently hundreds of them subsequently exterminated by either the security forces, the legitimate government security forces or the right-wing paramilitaries. You'll remember that many, many moons ago, we had André Gómez Suárez and Gwen Berniet on the show. André Gómez Suárez's PhD project, his thesis, it was a book that has now been published talking about the genocide of the Unión Patriótica. So worth reading if you can get your hands on it. I think it's in English. It should be out in most academic bookstores if that is of interest to you. So without further ado, I'm going to take a short break and I'll be back with Roxanne Cristalli on the line, and we'll be talking gender issues regarding the Colombian conflict, regarding Colombia in general, and we'll be talking about that for the remainder of the show because it's an incredibly timely and important subject about which to talk, especially at this point in Colombian history. So I hope you enjoy the show. Of course, we love to hear from you. That's at Colombia Calling if you want to get in touch on Twitter. Colombia Calling Radio is our website. And of course, you can get through on Facebook and ColombiaCalling@gmail.com. So just take a short break and I'll be right back after this with Roxanne Cristalli on the line. Thank you for listening.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And my very special guest on this episode 137 is up in Boston. Now, it's very exotic Boston, wintry Boston at the moment. Her name is Roxanne Cristalli, and she's a researcher on the subject of gender, violence, and conflict, PhD candidate up there, and she manages a humanitarian research program up there as well. And, well, I wanted her on the show so we could talk, I mean, we could, you know, tune in again into some of the more important issues taking place, and of course, coming to light now that we have quite an increased level of understanding, hopefully understanding of the peace dialogues between the FARC rebels and the government. But I think lots is being missed out. So I just wanted to have Roxanne on the show. So welcome.
Thank you for having me, Richard. I've been a fan of the show and I'm thrilled to be on it.
Oh, that's very flattering indeed. And now tell me, Roxanne, so now you're up there in Boston, you're up there in your office, but what is your connection to Colombia? Why is all of your time dedicated to Colombia?
I wish more of my time were dedicated to Colombia, to be honest. I think anyone who has ever lived there, worked there, or traveled there understands this sentiment. So I first came to Colombia in 2009-2010. At the time, I was working on developing a gender dimension of reintegration programs, particularly for former combatants. And what that means is essentially acknowledging that men, women, boys, and girls join armed groups for different reasons, have experiences within these armed groups that are very different depending on their gender, and therefore need to be demobilized and reintegrated into society in different ways. As I was working with a community-based group to develop this gender-sensitive approach to disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration, and I learned a tremendous amount. I was part of a beautiful community of people there. I was incredibly moved by the activism and thoughtfulness and resilience and warmth of Colombians. And I navigated what I think is a pretty familiar contradiction for those of us who love Colombia, the extreme beauty and deep love that seems to be emanating from the place right alongside the injustices and violence that have taken place there. And so that combination has troubled me. It's kept me coming back. And I'm thrilled to work there to this day. Between now and then, I've worked on a variety of research projects, both in terms of academic research, but also as a humanitarian practitioner, as a human rights advocate, involving both victims of the conflict as well as former combatants.
Well, it's pretty heavy going. Now, you know, so we're gonna keep it lightweight, but in as much as we can on this. It's amazing what you are doing, Roxanne. And when you came down to Colombia, did you have any preformed ideas of what you were going to meet with regards to what you are pursuing, these studies and so on, these investigations? Because I imagine that you've interviewed any number of ex-combatants, like former guerrillas, former paramilitaries and so on. I mean, it must have been really eye-opening.
It really was. I had worked in the humanitarian field in places that weren't Colombia before, and there are definitely comparative insights there. There are things that you learn in one context that show up elsewhere that sort of inform how you behave, how you do research, how you do your humanitarian work. I was incredibly moved by the wisdom and the persistence of Colombian activists, of Colombian human rights defenders, and of Colombian researchers. And I've learned a lot from how they pursue social change, from what types of questions they ask and don't ask, from how they stay safe, and mostly from how they stay optimistic. I've found that very often cynicism is the domain of the international researchers, of the international aid workers, of the foreigners. And very few of the Colombians that I've met have this attitude of resignation that we often bring to conflict-affected places or places in transition. And so that attitude of Colombians has really colored my own and has kept me returning to the country.
Incredible. Remind me of the year that you, or the time that you were here, the long period of time that you were here.
So the longer period of time was in 2010. So there was a lot less to be hopeful about. It was shortly after a series of scandals were exposed. The peace process, as we know it, was obviously not that far along. Things have changed quite a bit, and I know people are very cautious to not attach themselves fully to hope in Colombia until something materializes, but it's been quite a journey between now and then.
It has indeed. And so 2010, yes, so there was some things going on in 2010, and it wasn't, it's hard, like you say this, and you say the optimism of people, the love of people, but then balancing it with this sort of, I don't know, there's the morbid stories, the terrible stories coming out of various sort of state-abandoned areas and so on and so forth. I'm finding myself in this current moment having a real issue trying to talk to people about the peace dialogues because, you know, some people are either 100% against them or just very, very suspicious because we've been through dialogues before. None of them have got this far, let's say that. Let's get that out. But you know, they're very suspicious of what's being handed over. That's the terminology that they're using. Oh, we're handing over the country and so on and so forth. But, you know, and of course, as a foreigner, even though I study and observe and everything here and live here, as a foreigner, I feel quite, I have to be quite careful about my opinions. But at the same time, I say, well, shouldn't we be gambling on peace? Shouldn't we really? I mean, isn't that the end goal here with everything? But you know, obviously encompassing everything that we need to encompass. But surely Colombia is better in peace. And they go, well, you know, we've been there before. We've seen what they're doing. We know what's going to happen. Mark my words. And so, from going from a moment of euphoria, then I go into a trough of despair.
Absolutely, and I think you put your finger on the narrative challenge about Colombia, particularly in the stories that foreigners tell about Colombia, where on the one hand it is beautiful, it is incredibly seductive as a place, it is warm, it is kind, it is loving, it is all the stuff that the media campaigns tell you it is, right? So right around my first time there, it was the time of Colombia, the only risk of wanting to stay, the media campaign. And then on the other hand, you know, thinking about what it is that I do for a living, you ask yourself, the only risk for whom? Would victims really say the only risk is wanting to stay? Would people being persecuted for being human rights defenders really stand by that statement? And so I think it's hard to produce an honest and textured narrative that acknowledges both the violence and injustice and inequalities that have taken place there and continue to take place there in certain domains, while also acknowledging the beauty and not letting one overwhelm or sidestep or underplay the other.
I think that's true. That campaign, that pro-export or pro-Columbia campaign, the only risk is wanting to say, there were days when I thought it was great, and there were days that I thought it was just the pits, and I think that's Columbia, you know. I think when I weigh it up, I think, yeah, I think, you know, that shows the sort of duplicitous nature of the country, and like
that's
you said...
That's exactly right.
So very interesting on that. Now, you've been travelling, you've been all around, I mean, getting you here on the show has been an issue. Now, I know you've been up in St. Andrews in Scotland, and I mean, what takes you to these places?
Oh, so I have been on the road quite a bit. So I do a series of, I manage a series of research projects. So I work on gender and violence and conflict, and so a lot of my travel is in areas where my research takes place. At the moment, that is primarily Colombia, but I've also worked in Guatemala, Egypt, northern Uganda, places elsewhere in the Middle East, Mexico. And so I do mostly anthropological work, field work, and so that does require being there and attempting to observe these communities and their experiences quite closely. I also think another piece of the work is not just doing it extractively. It's not enough to ask people about their experiences of violence, take the data, and then write a report about it and do nothing with it. To me, that feels very, like a very extractive way to do research. So we're also thinking a lot about research use and research uptake. So on a recent trip, I was presenting findings from one of our research projects to the donor who funded the research and to decision makers who may be able to use this evidence in order to shift certain policies or certain practice. And they're also learning opportunities, learning from other practitioners working in other countries, other researchers, about how they are navigating a lot of these dilemmas and what it is that we can learn from other contexts.
But that's the thing, isn't it? With a lot of this academic research, it's you know, and I'm grappling with this a bit too at the moment. And I think that so much research comes out far too academic, and then it cannot be reused unless academics get it. You know, it's not in the sort of, let's say, the public domain.
That's exactly right, and that's a cause very near and dear to my heart. So the program that I manage here at the Feinstein International Center is called the Humanitarian Evidence Program. And part of its goal is to, in fact, make research usable and accessible. So not just promote research for the sake of research, but also to put it in the hands of decision makers, practitioners, our own research participants, to make sure that it still makes sense and that people can do something with it. And very often that actually requires translation. It requires, you know, taking a 300-page report and distilling it down to a 200-page report. It requires using different language. It requires using different visual information. It really requires thinking about research use as opposed to just research production.
Yeah, and no, I'm completely on board with that. And from my studies, in a couple of weeks' time, we're going down to La Macarena, not to Caño Cristales, but down to the region of La Macarena to start. There's like this is the first year of interviews of people, and what, you know, a potential peace accord would mean to them. The idea is that this will then go on for over 10, 15 years of studies to be able to take, you know, real information and watch it. Watch the evolution of how things change and how it, you know, how people's attitudes change, and of course, what kind of what kind of influence the state is going to have in such an isolated part of the world. So I think these things are so important, you know, the information is not only just for the academics but also for the people on the ground. You know, they can look back and say, look, this is what I said 10 years ago. You know, I think that would help.
Absolutely. I do think it also causes some frustration, and it raises a few different dilemmas. The first is people on the ground don't need academics to narrate their own experiences to them. They know what their experiences were. And in fact, I think that's where the frustration comes from, this idea that, you know, very often, even when we share results with them, we end up telling them what their own story was, but without any capacity for action. Particularly for those of us who aren't, you know, in the slash space of researchers slash practitioners slash other things. If you're just a researcher, it's hard to really deliver any particular immediate practical benefit to people who participate in your research. And in fact, a lot of the research ethics rules prevent against that, where, you know, if we were able to deliver certain programs that would affect people's incentives to participate in our research, and you're part of quite a messy system. But I think that very lack of actionability to the research is quite frustrating. And then I think the second piece of it is a little bit of a power piece, where quite frequently research participants narrate these experiences, particularly to foreign researchers, in the hope that they will reach a different audience. And by taking results back to them and to their community, that can itself be a source of conflict, a source of tension within the community, because we may be exposing certain harms or creating certain liabilities for them that wouldn't otherwise be quite as visible or quite as prominent. So I don't have a neat answer to this. It's something that I spent a lot of time thinking about. I'm part of a team called Lean Research, where we're trying to think through some of these dilemmas. You can check out their work at leanresearchhub.org. But it's an interesting mess of, you know, when we're talking about use of research, by whom and to what end, and how do we ensure that we protect research participants from certain harms that may appear in the process, or at least that we're being honest about what those risks are.
Very true, very poignant indeed. I'm going to look up that website. It's leanresearchhub.org, you said.
Cool.
Okay, well, excellent. Roxanne, we've done the first segment of this show. This is, we've been informing the people out there about what you're up to, what you're doing, the problems that this entails, the issues, and so on. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk to you further about your experiences in Colombia, and, of course, the role of gender in the peace dialogues here in Colombia. So this is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall talking to Roxanne Cristalli. Please don't go away. We'll be right back after this short break. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're talking to Roxanne Cristalli, who's up in Boston. We've been talking about some of the issues that, you know, face researchers and academics when they're studying. Let's say in this circumstance, the conflict, because we're talking about Colombia and we're talking about the issues here. And of course, Colombia is very much at the fore because of the peace dialogues. And I wanted to talk to Roxanne because we've got her here on the line. But there, you know, a month ago or now, there was a New York Times article which came out about was it peace and marks and free love in the jungle, something like that, Roxanne?
Yes, indeed. I think it was in a Columbia rebel camp, Marxism and free love reign.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, I saw it and I was like, oh. But even before I read it, I was like, oh, no. And then, you know, and okay, it may have given one side. Let me not slam other people in my profession, but, you know, I live in Colombia. I have a Colombian family. I have business here, and I pray for Colombia. But when I see those sorts of articles, and for me, it read like a travel article. It read like, oh, there's this kind of crazy guy ended up in a FARC camp, kind of really didn't know what he was doing there. But this spurred you into action, and you wrote basically a response in the Washington Post.
I did. So before I jump into my response, I actually want to touch on a couple of things I think the article did well.
Okay, very good.
And so the original piece, as I mentioned, written by Nicholas Casey for the New York Times, one thing that I do appreciate about it was that it focused on the anthropology of everyday life. Mm-hmm. I think very frequently we talk about war from above. We talk about war as a structural power system in abstraction. And what I do appreciate about Case's work and Case's reporting is that he did talk about what it is like to experience being in a guerrilla group, what everyday life looks like within it, and how different people in a group may experience that in different ways. And I think that is quite valuable. And I was very grateful for that approach. What motivated my own response, which, as you mentioned, appeared on the Monkey Cage blog of the Washington Post, was the fact that it seemed that the original article had performed very little gender analysis. Mm-hmm. And without gender analysis, we miss quite a lot about the dynamics of violence, the transition from it, and the recovery from it. And so that was the gap that I sought to correct.
very good. And you did cite some pretty, you know, some pretty horrific cases, didn't you? I mean, you can you enlighten the listeners out there to a little bit to the reality of, let's say, you know, being a woman in the guerrillas, in the FARC guerrillas. That's the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, but that's the FARC in the Spanish initials. But can you enlighten our listeners a little bit into what you wrote?
Absolutely. So I'd like to start just with what do we gain from gender analysis in general? Mm-hmm. And I think the starting premise is that men, women, boys and girls join armed groups for different reasons. They inhabit and occupy different roles within them. They therefore have different experiences. And those experiences could simultaneously be ones of vulnerability, but also of agency. And that was really what I was trying to explain in my piece, because very often a big misconception in how we talk, particularly about women within armed groups, is they were forcibly recruited, they're victims, they had no agency whatsoever. And what we do know about women in armed groups in Colombia and elsewhere is that that's not the full story. And at the same time, the fact that they did have some forms of agency, that they did experience some types of power and influence, however limited and however bounded, doesn't mean that they didn't, at the same time, experience some forms of gendered harm in the group. And so, while I focused on the FARC in my piece, and I'm happy to get into specifics in a second, I also think it's important to say this is a common story across many armed groups in Colombia and beyond, that it's also very important to look at this in state forces. So I think it's very seductive to blame non-state armed groups in general or the FARC in particular for all these gendered harms without critically examining other actors that have also been part of the equation. So in terms of what the gendered harms themselves look like, we do see limits to reproductive and sexual agency within the FARC. So the original piece talked about it in this free love domain, whereas over the years, we have seen the FARC control women's desire to have a baby. We have seen forced abortions. We have seen forced contraception. We have seen contraception in girls as young as 12 years old, at an age where really it is impossible to give meaningful consent. So this narrative of the FARC as this free love domain is really quite limited. Mm. On the agency side, for a lot of women, Colombian society is very patriarchal and very limiting itself, particularly in rural areas, particularly at the time in which they joined various armed groups. So the fact that they could have forms of agency and leadership and influence within the armed group, or at least that that's what they were promised, was really a stark contrast to where they were coming from and really a huge motivator to join the group in itself. And for some women, that was in fact part of the group's reality, that it wasn't just a false promise. So that was the dual narrative that I really tried to put across in the piece, that experiences of agency, experiences of power, experiences of influence can coexist alongside experiences of gendered vulnerability and gendered harm within these armed groups.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And so talking about this, it's, as you said, you know, Colombia is quite patriarchal, quite, I would say, fairly patriarchal country. And of course, machismo reigns supreme. And I know of all sorts of situations and have heard of all sorts of tales of dreadful relationships or, let's say, arrangements between men and women in the small town where I have my business, you know, you see the machismo right there up close in your face. But society as a whole, and you talk about the state actors. I know that the armed forces are tough here. I'll talk about a personal anecdote. Is that I study alongside a captain in the army, who's been in the front line for 15 years. He's a professional soldier, and he was looking for someone he needed someone for his classes to teach them history. So they were looking for someone with a doctorate in history. Various people applied, and one lady applied, and he had to do the research and the investigation on this person to find out if they were going to be the person let's say, appropriate for this job, found her Facebook page, saw that she was a very attractive young Colombiana, and said, no, she just can't have this job. She can't have this job because the soldiers will behave differently around her. I mean, so I sort of shudder to think what happens elsewhere.
Absolutely. And also, I do want to point out, very often we tend to use gender discrimination or gender inequalities that happen somewhere else to exoticize the problem. And just that story that you told, it's a story that has sometimes been told in the U.S. armed forces, right?
Okay.
Or even outside of the armed forces. I don't think that that's just a militarized problem. We have heard in other organizations, well, we can't let women in because they will be assaulted or because they will be distracting to men. So that sense of the feminization of distraction, or that, you know, men's concentration needs to be protected through female exclusion, I think is a common narrative, not just in Colombia, not just in armed groups, but in patriarchal societies everywhere. And I think noticing those threads and noticing what is different about war, but also what is not different, what is not specific to just places elsewhere, I think is very important for feminist curiosity in our lives.
Yes, definitely, definitely. Now, tell me a little bit about, tell the listeners a little bit about the gender situation right now regarding, let's say, the negotiating teams there in Havana. So, you know, we've had negotiations going on since November 2012. Well, official ones before the after the exploratory ones elsewhere. But tell me, you know, we don't see a lot of women at those tables there, do we? I mean, we don't see an equality in let's say, the breakdown of the teams, neither with the FARC and definitely not with the Colombian government.
Indeed. I have a lot to say on this. I will try to restrain myself to just 3 points.
Okay.
First is that very often, and again, not specific to Colombia, although Colombia is a case of this, to the extent that women participate in peace processes, they're presented as victims. Again, it's this idea of feminized vulnerability, feminized victimhood. And that's important. That is an important experience to narrate. However, it is not specific to women. And I think when we essentialize, when we equate femininity with victimhood, we're missing out on all these types of agency and power, all these roles, all these experiences that women have had, both during the war, but can also play in the transition and in the peace space. So that's the first point. The second is, there has been a very limited inclusion of women in the negotiating teams. I also think taking an intersectional look, so not just looking at gender, but also looking at ethnicity, you see Tanya Ningmeyer on the FARC team, who's a Dutch guerrilla, right? And asking ourselves, why is it that we don't see Colombian women? And what types of privilege and also what types of strategic decision-making are we seeing on behalf of not only the armed groups, but also the government in terms of whom they put forward and to what end? And I think this highlights the fact that gender can often be used as a strategic talking point, right? I am more progressive than you. Look at me, I brought a woman to the table, which brings me to the third point. I think I'd love to see us move beyond the add women and stir approach.
Yeah.
To peacemaking. I'd love to see a meaningful inclusion of not only women at the table, which is important, but also gender issues. So gendered experiences of harm, gendered participation in the war, gendered roles in the transition, and having that be a meaningful agenda item tackled by all. For me, that's where the meat of this is. And when the fight is about who is including women and how many of them, or rather when the conversation stops at that, we risk it just being window dressing, where women are just being used to check a box without asking ourselves, well, do they have equal power, both formal power and informal power, as the male negotiators? What issues do they speak to? Whom do those women represent? Which women are best positioned to be at the peace tables? And how do we ensure that gender issues don't just become the domain of women, but that they become an agenda item for all negotiators?
I think you've struck on several incredibly important and poignant points there. I want to say, you know, I don't know a great deal
about this, the issue, and you're speaking from a real the position of strength and knowledge, and I don't want it to be like a greenwash in environmental practices, as you say, to add women and stir, but it. You know, I get the idea and the impression that if we were to confront, let's say, Humberto de la Calle or Sergio Jaramillo, they would give that response, the response that you gave us just now, is like, well, you know, it's if there were people or women of this standard, we don't want to just have them there as let's say, window dressing. But I personally believe there must be academics and there must be negotiators who are women who could be there representing Colombia and the best interests of the Colombian people. Are you in agreement?
Indeed, and in fact, I would say they're in fact Colombian women and Colombian women in armed groups.
Yeah.
There have been very prominent female militants. So, you know, when I hear you say that, I just think, you know, do we need to make binders full of women FARC fighters for them to choose from? I do find the competence argument very limiting. You know, the fact that, well, we got the best of the fighters and the women didn't make the cut for me. Just isn't very compelling.
Do you know what's going on with the famous guerrillera? Her name was Karina, the one who sowed, some pretty terrible, nightmares up in Urabá, wasn't it? Karina, was that her name?
Indeed, and that's a very interesting case because it highlights a couple of things about gender and violence relevant to our conversation. The first is that women's violence is seen as more transgressive.
Mm.
So a lot of the very violent acts that Karina perpetrated are not too dissimilar from violent acts that Colombian men have perpetrated within armed groups of all persuasions. But the fact that she's female, the fact that she is perceived to violate these feminine expectations of being nurturing and caring and peaceful, or even participating in an armed group, but in a support role as a cook or as a nurse, I think that's part of why we treat her violence differently. And we are seeing that to be an issue for women demobilizing, where once they are perceived to have violated social expectations of femininity, which are themselves very constructed and very limiting, it is very hard for them to renegotiate this redefinition of who they are, how they fit into the transitional and peacetime Colombian landscape, and how they redefine and reestablish their gender roles.
Yes, it's true. Now, of course, I fell into the trap, of course, because I've only read the newspaper El Tiempo has said about her.
You're not alone. I think the trap is very real, and I also think it says a lot about how it is that we write these stories and what we find interesting about them.
Of course, and I try not to read as much at the moment because it becomes very distracting. But so tell me now, we're approaching. The sit-down between the ELN, so the National Liberation Army, and the government, potentially, or they've confirmed in Ecuador, despite, and my sincerest condolences and sympathies go out to Ecuador after this terrible spate of earthquakes. But so they will be hosting the talks, the dialogues in Ecuador. Can we expect, let's say, better from the ELN and maybe the government's team going down there?
It's a good question, and to be honest, it's hard to say. I do think a lot of design goes into peace processes, and if those designing this peace process wanted to learn from other examples or even from the FARC experience, they could. So there are ways to set the agenda, there are ways to set the participants, there are ways to set the formal and informal activities that do take a lot of these gendered lessons into account. It's hard to make a prediction. One thing I do find interesting is just thinking about what are we going to do with all these actors that have been violent actors involved in the conflict but don't quite rise to the threshold of an armed group. And so how do we think about them moving forward? How do we think about the Bakrim, the criminal bands, which, you know, are very often being written about by researchers, by the press, by the state itself? non-political actors, non-ideological actors, just criminal actors, with emphasis on just, only criminal actors. But they're in fact a huge part of the conflict landscape, and not really at the table, not really a part of the thinking about this transitional time. Similarly, thinking about gender in actual gangs, in Medellin and beyond, I think that's a real issue. Thinking about masculinity as part of gender analysis. So not just saying, okay, we'll talk about gender when it's about women, and making the two be synonymous code words for each other, but thinking about how do we demobilize men as men? How do we think about gendered harms men have both suffered and inflicted? And how do we reestablish masculinity in Colombian transitional society? For me, those are the really big meaty issues that I don't see being explicitly talked about in a lot of these processes at the moment.
What worries me when we talk about the sort of the let's say the, you know, the agenda for the dialogues and what's been agreed and what hasn't been agreed and or what's been left out is I don't think and maybe I, you know, I'm going to tap your knowledge for this because you've traveled everywhere, but it's not, for me, it's not being expressly, what's going on, expressly explained to the public what's happening, you know. And I think that's one of the great failures. Maybe they're doing it on purpose. Maybe this is on purpose, you know, just to keep on moving forwards if you like, but to keep on moving. But you're alienating the population without really truly explaining what's going on in Havana or what will go on in Ecuador, wherever they decide to hold in Ecuador. I mean, I worry, you know, is that you see people posting, because of course social media is the plague for this, but that all guerrillas are going to receive $1,800,000 in salary and so on and so forth. It's just not technically correct, but that's without informing the people, how can we move forward?
Indeed. I think you're right. I think this information piece is a huge part of the equation, particularly if there's going to be buy-in into the peace process. Because as we know from other contexts, peace is not just about what is agreed at the table, but it is more meaningfully and more importantly about what is implemented, what people experience as peace, what people expect and fear. And I think there needs to be that closing of the loop between what is agreed and what is communicated to people to inform those expectations and to allay those fears. I will say, Colombian organizations are doing a phenomenal job of attempting to put a lot of these issues on the agenda, and they're doing a lot of the invisible work around the peace process, in the informal peace process, in the communication of what's going on at the peace table to the Colombian population. And so I think there's something to be said about paying attention to what are non-state actors involved in the peace.
Yeah.
Asking, what are they doing? What are they talking about? And taking our cue from them.
That's very good. Now I understand you write a lot, not only academic things, but you have your own blog as well, don't you, Roxanne?
I do. It's called Stories of Conflict and Love.
Stories and of Conflict and Love.com. So people can check out your writing there, your personal writing.
Indeed.
When are we going to see your books coming out, Roxanne?
Oh well, I have to write them first.
But it won't be long in coming. We know you're destined for great things.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I'm so glad to be on the show and to continue to be a happy listener.
Oh, thank you kindly. Now, in the last couple of minutes, take a perfect world. Yeah, well, it's not a perfect world, but take a perfect situation and say, what would you? For everyone listening out there, that's my one-year-old son being raucous. But in a perfect world, in a perfect situation, what recommendations would you deliver directly, let's say, to the government negotiators, let's say, in Havana at the moment, to say, I, Roxanne Cristalli, an academic, you know, who is an expert in gender, violence, and conflict, and a humanitarian, this is what I have to say. What would you say?
I would start with the fact that I'm not an expert, so I would tell them to listen to the local experts, to listen to people who have devoted their lives to understanding the conflict, and to not outsourcing knowledge to foreigners or to even researchers or academics. And I don't mean for this to be self-defeating or to undermine the work that my colleagues or I do. But it is to point out that the real knowledge comes from experience, and that is experience Colombians have, that is experience they have in articulating all these forms of violence that they have been through or witnessed or observed. And so I would start there. The second thing I would say is to take gender seriously, to think about what is it that we learn if we exhibit gender curiosity about how people experience the world, and specifically violence and transition and peace, differently? And I think that opens up a whole host of questions worthy of exploration. And then the third thing I would say is to commit to the peace, we really need to look at the ugly logistics of peace. Who is financing the peace and how? In some senses, it's a lot easier to finance war, and the same actors that finance the war aren't necessarily going to be the ones that are making the payments to victims, that are paying the stipends to combatants demobilizing. And how do we make financing the peace attractive? How do we find investors for peace and not have that agenda be masculinized, be rendered patriarchal, or be militarized, or, as has happened in many other places, that agenda be made secondary to the securitized agenda or to the agenda of war? And so those are some of the questions that I would ask, again, with the caveat that my questions aren't the questions that are the ones that should be asked or at the forefront.
Amazing humility from you there, Roxanne, because I, for one, and my listeners out there will know that you are indeed an expert, if not a Colombian, but you are indeed an expert on these issues. And I'd like to take this moment to say thank you so much for your time and such detailed and interesting and measured answers that can only serve to inform people and educate people further, and really some of the situations and the scenarios that Colombia has to face in the coming months and years and decades, in truth. I mean, that's the reality of it. So thank you again for your time. I know you're very busy. I wish you all the best in your exams, because they're coming up shortly, aren't they? And we know you're going to get through with flying colors.
Thank you, and thank you very much for having me, Richard, and all the best to you and your vibrant family.
Yes, vibrant this evening, of course, as I'm recording. But thank you kindly again. This has been Colombia Calling, episode 137. I've been Richard McColl, talking to Roxanne Cristalli in Boston, up in the United States, up in Massachusetts. I hope you've enjoyed today's informative show. Please tune in next week when we'll have another interesting interviewee on the line somewhere else or here from Colombia. So thank you again for listening. Signing off, Richard McColl for Colombia Calling.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.